into a recess as our first presenter, Mr. Patowski, is right now in the Revenue Committee finishing up his description of the forecast along with Mr. Warner, and they are instrumental in our schedule today. So we anticipate they'll be available in about 15 minutes. So if we can, yes, Representative.
Is that the hourly forecast that we get now? I want to be clear on that. Yeah.
The forecast is more regular. It's the reaction to the forecast that changes hourly.
Okay. Mm-hmm. It's the dark.
With that, we will be in recess until 10:24. Call the Joint Committee on Ways and Means to order, or back to order. And we're going to lead off with our revenue forecast. Mr. Patowski, we've heard something about what you're going to present. So if you want to come up and give us additional detail, we're pleased to have you this morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Mr. Chair, members of the Joint Ways and Means Committee. For the record, my name is Tom Patowski, State Economist with the Office of Economic Analysis. With me today is Michael Kennedy, also with the Office of Economic Analysis. Very briefly, I'll jump right into this so we can get on with the presentation. We've presented before to you a little bit of our methodological approach. The process is that we do an economic forecast, and that economic forecast also feeds into our revenue forecast. We have a pre-meeting where we meet with the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors. And during that pre-meeting, we discuss national issues and Oregon issues. A number of national variables do drive our Oregon economic model. After we have those discussions, we do our simulations, then we have all-day meetings with what's called our insiders group. This is made up of government agency people that either provide us with data and information or use our information, and we discuss the economic modeling with them. Then we meet with what's called the outsiders, which is once again the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors. So we meet with them for the second time during the quarter. And they also then look at our economic model. We discuss the economy, and we sort of finalize then what the economic model is looking like. That economic model variables feed into our revenue models. We finalize that, and then we present quarterly, as we are doing today, the forecast. The next forecast will be the May 15th forecast. Every odd year during legislative sessions, rather than presenting in June, we bump that up to a May 15th forecast. And I'm going to go quite quickly so we can get on to the revenue numbers. Some of these you've already seen. Investment, one bright spot here is we are seeing this starting to bottom out, which is good news for the economy. Consumer sentiment, it's fallen. This is an estimate of where it may fall today. The actual number is being released by the University of Michigan. Our concern here is associated with consumer spending, also with business sentiment. This has dropped. Our recent experience with possibly a similar war situation has been back when Kuwait was invaded, and you can see the large drop that happened there. I will return to that issue when we talk about our risks to the forecast. Federal Reserve has dramatically decreased interest rates. There was also a continuing weak economy in 2002. They also dropped a little bit more. The expectation is that when recovery does occur, the Federal Reserve will turn around and ratchet those interest rates up along with recovery. This is national aspects right here, whether there's a recovery signal or a double dip. Just going through those, although we've seen some softness in quite a bit of these indicators recently, there still does not appear to be an indication that we're headed for another recession, a back-to-back situation. Although this definitely has been a jobless recovery for the U.S., it appears that that is just extending itself out a lot longer than what we expected. And really, that's kind of the theme for Oregon also. For Oregon's economy, One bright spot has been exports, has done marginally better. The falling U.S. dollar has promoted our exports. Year over year now, we believe that 2002 we're up possibly about 13% where we were 2001. So that is a marginally good sign for us. This historical look at Oregon employment, you can see at the very end of this graph, the bouncing around the horizontal axis, the zero, in a sense, effect of job growth, this jobless recovery. This jobless recovery is extending itself even farther. We'll know more about this picture, by the way, which is just being delivered as we speak by the Oregon Employment Department. They are presenting the numbers for January today, and also their re-benchmark employment numbers. So we're going to get a look, a better look, to see exactly, you know, was this recession as this mild, or possibly was it even deeper, based on better numbers? And also, is this jobless recovery still to the same aspect as we've been seeing? So unfortunately, the data is only being released right now, and we will definitely incorporate that new re-benchmark data into our forecast. Regionally, these are unseasonally adjusted unemployment rates. Also, the unemployment rate for Oregon is being released as we speak for January, so these are December numbers. The odd part here is that in the past, in the upper Willamette Valley and even in the central Willamette, lower Willamette Valley, we had seen interest rates in the 2.5% to 3.5% range. That's what we were used to. But now we see that they are poking up towards 7%. These rates naturally are high during this time of the year. The seasonal type of work and so on, generally, these rates do go up. This is that aspect of this flat jobless recovery. You can see in the finishing the 82 recession, job growth at 11 months into recovery was already 2.5% above where it was at the start of the recovery. We are barely 0.5% up in job growth with about a year out after the start of the recovery, if we believe it started in January of 2002. So very, very lackluster recovery. Our outlook for the Oregon overall employment, we believe it will follow the U.S. out of recession. It will be a little stronger growth in the outer years, but much more mild than what we've seen before. We don't believe we're going to see this big jump up in growth that we saw previously. And I'm going to return to that issue when we talk a little bit about high tech. Lumber and wood, we think it's stabilizing out some in 2003, but it's been a very, very tough industry, of course, over the past 20 years. High tech is a volatile industry. Lots of valleys and lots of mountains. Took quite a drop here in this recession. But we believe that this industry is a much more mature industry these days. We're not into the period of what we might call the baby boom aspect of high tech. We're not probably going to see a lot of new sightings of firms in Oregon with huge employment numbers associated with them like we did in the mid-1990s. We believe that job growth will come back, but it will be quite muted. Construction has had a tough time through this recession. If you're in single residential families, not too bad, but any other type of construction outside of, say, some public works, it's been a very, very tough going for this industry. Per capita income, after we were at the U.S. average back in about 1979. We lost a lot of high-paying lumber and wood jobs at that time. And those jobs that were lost, there weren't any high-paying wages to replace them. High-tech came along, did help to replace some of those lost high-paying jobs, but then we had the Asian financial crisis, then the world recession, and it's been a long, hard road. For per capita income in the state. Comparison of some of our last three forecasts. It is a forecast. There are risks to each forecast. When we start to see what has happened in the economy, we take that information into account. And the unfortunate side here is that most of the risks have been coming true on the downside rather than the upside recently. And thus we've been decreasing our employment growth aspects that we think are associated with the economy. Our forecast for personal income growth, the Bureau of economic analysis, which does these forecasts and estimates for personal income for states. They did up their forecast slightly for 2002, although that's just about done. That caused us to raise marginally. I say it's basically exactly the same for 2003. But we think going forward, we've lowered that personal income measure going out to those outer years. And then finally, to emphasize once again, there are risks to a forecast. We give you a number, for example, of what we think employment's going to be, and Michael will be showing you in terms of revenue numbers. But that is a estimate itself around which there is a bound of numbers that are likely outcomes. And there are outcomes that possibly could be higher than those numbers and outcomes that could be less than those numbers. And so some of our risks, especially at the national level with Congress and the Federal Reserve, the packages in order to stimulate the economy at the federal level, possibly these could be more similar than what we're expecting, spillover effects into Oregon. Geopolitical is a huge bag of risks. We have the possible war with Iraq. We have the problem with North Korea going to the orange level of security code. The war with Iraq, what we have in our model is that this war is expected to occur, to be short, say about 5 weeks long, and then be over. The look that we're seeing is that the price of oil, which has already reached up to about $40 a barrel, will most likely possibly spike even more at the event of war. But given that we've not seen war yet and the anticipation has caused that price to go up, likewise, if there's anticipation that the war is going to be over soon, we'll see that price come down quite quickly, and it could come down to the low 20s. So there is a little sort of mini disruption in the economy if war, and then it's over. The risk here is that that's not the scenario. Instead, the war lasts much longer. Rather than 5 weeks, it's 5 months or 6 months. That would cause energy prices to stay up higher, causing the cost of businesses to be higher, possibly igniting a stagflation situation where you get the combination of dropping of business activity but a rising of prices. Similar 1970s type story. Energy prices, I was more hopeful about this area just in our December forecast. I'm less hopeful about it now. We had been, previous winter, we had seen good snowfall. We'd seen the Enron trading scandal being revealed and that being taken care of. We saw the market prices coming down. People like PGE, they had forward contracts. When they come due, they recontract at these lower market rates. We saw Northwest Natural go to the Public Utility Commission asking for a rate decrease. It was looking very promising. Now we see another El Nino year, another bad snowpack situation. We have Bonneville Power Administration trying to cover their debts, passing on higher rates. So this, we don't believe it's enough to push us into recession in Oregon, but it is enough to, once again, make this jobless-type recovery continue even longer. Stock market, we don't believe that there will be another huge market correction, but we will experience $100, $200, even $300 movement days will be most likely in either direction over the next couple of months. So we don't see it as a factor either horribly hitting the economy in Oregon in terms of our capital gains, and thus what Michael will talk about in capital gains realized tax revenue. But it won't be a detriment either to any huge extent. Corporate reporting, I think this is, I may eventually drop this from an issue. I think the accounting world has really come to the forefront. The SEC is being very careful about this. We're seeing a lot of changes that should build back confidence in corporate reporting. State and local governments, we have to keep in mind that we do have a mixed economy. There is not a separate private sector economy and a private public sector economy, and if one goes down, it doesn't affect the other. They are intertwined. And what we're seeing now is that state governments, and Oregon definitely showing among the worst of them, in terms of their tax revenues, are going to be latecomers to this recession and thus a latecomer in terms of a drag on recovery. You know, businesses can react quite quickly to these situations. In terms of governments, we see tax collections coming at a delayed effect when they come in relative to what the activity was occurring. And it is a very tough job to collectively get together in a public sense in order to make very hard decisions of cutting services or trying to figure out how to raise revenues. Those things just aren't decided on overnight. So there tends to be more of a lag effect as to when you see this effect occurring. But whatever you do, unfortunately, whether raising taxes or cutting spending, cutting services, that ends up being a drag on the economy because you, unlike the federal government, you have to balance the budget. High-tech industry, we're starting to see some good signs here, all but very weak. Novellus, who is a provider of semiconductor equipment, has shown some upbeat signs, and some of their also competitors are a little more upbeat for the second half of 2003. We need to take that with a little bit of grain of salt. This has been mentioned many, many times before. If you mention it enough, it'll eventually come true. We believe that with some of the other indicators, semi-book-to-bill ratio seems a little better, PC sales are picking up, at some time firms are going to reinvest in high technology. They've been putting it off for quite a while. Things wear out, they become obsolete, you've got to upgrade. The software will also catch up with the new technology in IT areas. That will provide greater productivity. Firms will finally jump into that bandwagon and get those. The big question is how long do they sit on the sidelines based on the uncertainty that's out there, especially with things like the possible war with Iraq. And that's kind of our economic outlook. We're still in a jobless recovery. It is taking longer for this recovery to change from a jobless one to a job-gaining recovery. We see the second half of this year being better definitely than the first half, building strength as we get to 2004 and 2005.
Thank you. Are there questions at this time?
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Kocher. This is, I think, the seventh forecast that we had that is forecasting less revenue than we anticipated receiving. And my recollection of what's been happening is that we've been given an operative number some weeks out from the actual forecast being released, and then that we've been working with. When we actually get the forecast, the number's been substantially bigger. Can you talk to us about what happens in the process that that causes that big adjustment right at the end of it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, the number that we had been talking about before was based on our December forecast. And so as we're coming through this whole process, and, for example, one of the most common questions I get, like for a question for today, will be, well, tell me exactly what the May forecast will be. And that's a very difficult thing to do because we want to see what information has come in. We're still lagging a month behind. Now, what we're doing is we've talked with LRO to keep them in the loop, and we've been providing information of what we think what we've seen information at the moment of what we're expecting. And what we gave out before was a range. We said it could possibly be down another $300 million. And what we're going to be presenting today is that it's down. We're presenting a forecast down for the rest of the forecast of $244 million. That I don't see as a dramatic change from our statement of how much it could be down by. So I just want to tell you that we try to keep abreast of information that's coming in, and as that information comes in, we need to change our story to reflect that new information. Does that answer your question?
May I have a follow-up?
Please.
The I think that you sense the frustration that we have and that we have had all through the interim as we've come in when we have been given a kind of an operative number for how much we have to balance to and tried to cobble together some kind of solution to that number. And then the a matter of days before the forecast is actually supposed to come out, the number has dramatically changed. And that hasn't happened just this time. That's happened consistently over the interim. And, I don't know that I did get the information that I need for you about why it is so late in the process that the shift suddenly occurs. I mean, why isn't there more of a, why are we given a number to work with, and then suddenly that number has become much bigger, and that appears to be a consistent issue through all of the seven revenue forecasts.
Do you want to?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, what will happen in the interim is that we will release a status on what we've just seen. So month by month, we'll say the last month, here's what happened to tax collections. And in general, we will not base any expectations about future forecasts on that. I mean, we prepare a forecast using all the 3 months of information in the prior weeks to releasing a forecast. We do not actually have another number anywhere during there. We do tend, and LRO will also track these numbers, and so you'll get these numbers coming from a variety of places. In fact, it's not necessarily that we have told somebody, oh, it's going to be down $90 million. Anybody out there can look and say, oh, well, withholding was down $5 million. It's probably going to be down X million, and that number floats around. But in fact, except for specific and explicit situations where we have been attributed as saying, okay, you wanted a range, well, 300 either way. Except for that, there's not much we can do to control just numbers being expressed by any given individual and floating around. Sometimes it's attributed to us, and we would never have made a statement like that prior to releasing a forecast.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, I guess maybe one of the instances that recently happened was there was a talk of possibly $90 million that it would be down. That never came from our office at all. Lots of rumors go around about these sort of numbers. The other aspect, and I understand your frustration, you have one of the most difficult jobs in the world in the state with these drops in revenues. And what you've had to wrestle with is coming into each of these special sessions, we would drop the forecasts as we would look out, because the risks have all come true generally on the downside of a range of where numbers could fall, and we needed then to drop the revenue forecast. And you have the horrible job then of meeting in these special sessions, and how much do you cut? And the very tough thing to do is here's our forecast. You've kind of balanced almost to the forecast. And thus, if the economy isn't going the direction we believed it was, if the downside risks start to come true, then we drop the forecast. It almost immediately, because there's very little cushion at all left, pushes you out of balance again. And you're stuck once again with a very tough decision making. So it's what we hope to provide you for today is we are changing our sort of reporting approach to you. In the past, we've been discussing in our own office and with other agencies. Don't throw a lot of numbers out because people wonder what number is the right number. Really try to stick to one baseline number, because there could be confusion over more numbers. We're ditching that type of viewpoint, and we're saying what we need to do is not just talk to you as we did over the years about the risks around a forecast, but now provide you with a boundary of numbers that we think are possible around this particular forecast. And it's our job to not have you be confused about more numbers, is to explain what they mean. So we understand your frustration, I think the process was such that you felt like you had hardly any choice but to go right to the forecast. And unfortunately, that forecast number does have a bound around it of likely outcomes that could occur. And with the downside risks are the ones that's been happening over and over in this economy, that's caused us to lower those forecasts, cause further frustration for you. It causes frustration for us, too.
May I have one follow-up?
Yes.
The a big piece of the frustration, too, is the, I think, tied to what you are forecasting out in front. I mean, I'm looking at all those graphs that you've got and seeing that you still have a strong upward line. It doesn't go up as far, but you still have a relatively short time before that upturn is going to occur. And I think that the trust in this building about whether that's going to happen or not is really huge. And those of us that look out into what's going on in the real world outside of this building economically have very little cause for optimism that we're going to see revenues increase on the kind of slope that you have them on there. And I think it would be very interesting to have more discussion about what you're basing those assumptions on. I mean, my background in the wood products industry, I don't see any cause for optimism there. And I remember when I first came into this process in the 99 session that we were being told back then that the industry was going to be pulling out of the doldrums that they were in and that this was imminently going to happen. So I think that there does need to be a different way to look at the probability of the forecast that you're putting in place actually coming to be.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, one of the steps we're taking at the moment is we are building a separate, what we call a leading economic indicator model for the state of Oregon. This is taking into account all sorts of variables that hopefully will be able to tell us a little better once we see turning points. Now, the other issues that you've talked about, I can talk to people out in the economy that think our forecast is way too pessimistic, if you can believe that. And they are people that are business people and so on that feel that, you know, I think biotech's going to be coming and high-tech's really going to come out a lot stronger than we believe. In our model, by the way, high-tech doesn't return to pre-recession employment levels until 2008. So we have a very, very slow rate rise in that. And so what we want to be able to do is then provide some other type of aspect, like this leading economic indicator model, that hopefully will help us with some turning point aspects that will hopefully lead us to being able to tell when those things do occur. Now, I think you're very right. There needs to be broader discussion about what sort of economy we're looking at in the future. We are concerned about offshore sourcing of high tech. We know with the lumber and wood products industry, it's a very, very tough industry. You have huge competition not only from Canada and the drop of the tariffs that have occurred and hardly have stopped the imports at all coming in from Canada for our softwood producers here, the wood that comes in from across the country, from the southeast part of the United States, South America, New Zealand, all over the place. It's very, very tough competition for that industry. And so we, with the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors, we try to talk with these people that are out, that are these experts in these areas. We have someone from the lumber and wood products industry on the council, someone from high tech, from the energy area, from forestry, to sort of help us with these aspects. But that discussion should always be out there. It's continuous, and we welcome any help that you can give us, too, on our quest to get better forecasts.
Thank you.
Thank you. I just want to say that it's very convenient to beat you up for this forecast. I can, and for the economic conditions we're in, and someday I'm confident we might get to a position where we would examine perhaps some of the foundations for our problems, like our not trying to encourage our timber industry as we should. We've ignored that. This is not the forum for that. But I also want you to know that having been in this room on many prior occasions, and I know Senator Dukes has been here too, I can vividly recall the predecessor of Senator Morse beating, I believe it was you, or Mr. Warner, for being unduly pessimistic in prior forecasts and therefore causing the kicker to kick. And he was just beside himself. And again, down on the forecaster. But I want you to know that you're obviously going to be subject to some criticism, but I think what we have to do is forecast or concentrate on what you've stated here and get about dealing with our budget facing up to some tough numbers that you're presenting. So, again, a convenient target, but I'm confident you're doing your level best and you're improving it all the time, and it's just you don't have a great story to present, but that's not necessarily your fault, in my view. Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Popowski, I'm not aiming at you. last May, the forecast last May was one of the forecasts, if my memory is correct, that was off what we anticipated by a significant magnitude. Very significant magnitude. And one of the things that was brought out in the discussion of that forecast was that the May forecast was perhaps the most volatile in some sense, in that it was based on really hard numbers. Whereas you're getting quarterly reports, you're getting withholding, you're looking at all these indicators, you're really getting hard numbers on some things when you do the May forecast in terms of returns coming in. In your mind, even though you've given this a 90% in this probability of the forecast going down no more than $100 million more, you can still consider this May forecast to be the most volatile of the forecast you'll have?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, I would say all other sort of conditions equal, that statement is relatively true, because you have in the last quarter, you have final payments, refunds are coming out, they're being processed. We may not have all that information to our hands by the time we have to do the May 15th forecast. We also have two estimated payments that occur in the second quarter of the year. There'll be a big estimated payment in June that we won't have information on yet. So in that sense, it is the possible volatility of what we may see in actual collections coming in. It tends to be stronger during this second quarter when the May forecast comes out than usual. Did you want to say?
It's coming. Five slides down the road.
But what I'd like to say, too, is, for example, last May 2001, the employment numbers that were just estimated at the time showed positive growth in employment in the first quarter of 2001. A year later, when the Oregon Employment Department re-benchmarked their employment numbers, that first quarter was a drop of jobs, which we had no knowledge of when we were making the forecast. So it's those also difficulties are incurred in making the forecast.
Thank you.
Senator Carter?
Actually, Mr. Chairman, you spoke to my issue, and that is the one of non-probability of statistical datatizing and how it's a non-science that these guys do. And so you reflected my comments.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Potosky, I realize your job is one both science and art, and I'm in the same field in different areas, so I have some sympathy for you, but it does make our job more difficult, and I'm not here to shoot the messenger. None of us like to get bad facts. What I'm concerned about is a replay of what happened after our last recession, and in my part of the state, we never recovered. The jobs came back. The jobs came back at substantially lower wages. This in a state that it depends primarily on the income tax for its revenues. And so everything I keep seeing shows the number of jobs will increase slowly, but it will increase. But I'm concerned that our revenues may not increase the same level because we're so dependent on income tax. If those jobs don't come back, as it did in the Portland area, at least, in the high-tech industry, not the rest of the state for a great degree of the last 10 years, that we will still see flat revenues. And that drives the discussion that's building about cuts in revenues, Bo. What is your sense, if you have any, about the types of jobs coming back and what those jobs look like as far as income is concerned?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, I'll just quickly answer that because actually Michael has, when gets into the revenue forecast, will show that we have changed our view of what we think are going to be wage growths, and we've lowered it substantially out in the future. But I think you're right. As we're not probably going to see the sort of high-tech jobs coming back to the same degree as we did before. These are still fairly high average paying jobs, but your days of signing bonuses at high tech are most likely over, which is another extra boost that we would have collected taxes on, for example. Or the stock options when they're exercised, and that working through also a tax collection process. That will be lessened too. So all these other items that are also related to wages and salaries that were boosting up our tax revenues, we don't think are going to be coming back as strongly. To the extent that really we turn into a more tourism-based economy, those wages and salaries associated with that sector tend to be much lower than with the manufacturing sector. So to the extent we would go down that, we would also see a lowering of wage growth occurring, as an example.
Thank you.
A few further questions?
It's not even segregated.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the both Joint Ways and Means Committee, for the record, Michael Kennedy, economist with the Office of Economic Analysis. And I'm going to review the revenue forecast. The first thing I would like to get into is what we've done in recent months to address this issue of forecast error and predictability. And in January, we met to discuss the methodology underlying this forecast. And one of the points that was made there is that the models that are in place today were built in the early 80s and are pretty much the same today as they were then. For the most part, because for two decades, the only thing they did wrong was underpredict revenues. And if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Kind of was there. There were incremental changes to address some changes I'm going to talk about here, but they really haven't changed a whole lot. When, in fact, two things have changed that need to be taken into account. First, they'd had far less information to deal with back then. And second, the tax base was much different. And those need to be addressed today. And that's something that, in fact, one of the things we've done is I've gone back to scratch and constructed another way of looking at modeling income in Oregon. Traditionally, it's just been income, and income begets liability, and for many years, that's the way that the future was forecasted, when in fact, the composition of our gross taxable income has changed significantly, and that needed to be addressed with the help of Department of Revenue and some new databases they have. We've now gone back and are modeling our taxable income based on components, which are very different and subject to very different rates of change and are driven by different factors. And so it's a much more rigorous and detailed model, and I'll show some statistics in a second. But in general, you have eight components of taxable income, and those are related to the variables that you would think would drive them. Retirement income would be 65 and older population, and some measure of pension values, CPI weight growth. You have capital gains as a separate component. That's pretty much explained entirely by changes in the stock market, and we have market indices. So that type of scenario. And then finally, you have a history of effective tax rates. How much of gross taxable income ends up being liability and paid to Oregon in the form of taxes. Using a forecast of a tax rate and your gross income, you then have a liability forecast, which is the dollars we eventually expect to come into Oregon, plus or minus a few dollars. So let's look at some of the statistics underlying this model. The first two columns here are the share of overall gross taxable income across these components. So you can see now the eight components, these are primarily driven by the structure of tax filing forms, because that's where we're getting our information. So, and that really drives what these components are. But as you can see, one of the primary points here is how the composition has changed over time. This is 1987 to 2000. And one important point here is the drop in wages as a share of all income. Wages tend to be a lot more stable than other forms of income. They do fluctuate, but not nearly to the degree as some of these other categories. And so as wages have become less of taxable income, the volatility of taxable income goes up because some of the other components, in particular capital gains, which more than doubled its share, are extremely more volatile. Schedule E income there, which is rents, royalties, and S-corps, S-corp income is also much more volatile, as would be proprietorship income. And so this is one of the underlying causes for the increased instability in our tax revenues, but also points out our need to focus on each of these categories separately rather than lumping them all together. Now, the next two columns here really are at the heart of the major change we've had between the last forecast and this forecast, particularly out in the outer biennium. When we've actually had to go component by component and address the expectations for those incomes, it is a very different story than just looking back and saying, well, income has generally grown roughly 9% per year. Isn't 7% a reasonable growth rate? Now you actually have to relate each of these components to the underlying forecast in economic factors and really make hard stories for why, if you think there's going to be significant growth, where is it going to come from in particular? Is it more jobs? Is it higher wage rates? What is it? And, in fact, that had a significant impact on our forecast relative to the prior forecast, just going through this exercise, as you've noticed from the numbers that have been distributed. One important point here to note while I'm still on this, from 87 to 2000, the annual growth rate in our gross taxable income was about 8%. For the forecast period, from 2000, that high point, out to 2009, it's down to 4.2%. That is a substantial decline in growth expectations. I imagine that 4 or 8 forecasts ago, that number would have been a lot higher had you calculated it with this model. And so our projection going forward incorporates a lot of these risk factors, outsourcing of high-tech jobs to other countries and or other states, dragged by the state and local government budget crisis. Issues like that are factored into this scenario, and you can see there. Net capital gains, if you look at our forecast there, we do not return to capital gains income levels of 2000 ever in this forecast horizon. Stock market comes up and those increase, but they never actually reach the $6 billion number we had in 2000. And that's just in actual terms, but when you consider price inflation, that we're actually talking about somewhat of a decline in real values here. So it's a significantly different story than one that's represented by an optimistic assumption of future growth. Now, the benefit here is not only that we think this will improve the forecast for taxable income and thus collections, but it's also that after the fact you can tell exactly what happened when you have revenues deviate from forecast. Where did it occur? What didn't pan out the way you thought? Was it the stock market? Was it small businesses versus wages, et cetera? And so you have a much better idea of what's going on and then the means to correct it. It points you in the direction of where you need to be looking to understand this variation in the forecast. There are still two caveats with this. Even though historically this model performs very well at mapping gross income to these other economic variables, for one, the latest information we have on these data are 2001. So 2002 is a forecast. It's already done and gone, but we're still forecasting it because the latest data you have from income tax returns is 2001. 2002s we won't have until after all those returns are in, and with extensions, that tends to be about October, November. They're finally cleaned, and we know about next January what actually happened in terms of details about Oregon's income a year after the tax year closes. So that's one issue. And the other issue has been, historically, yes, there is a good association between these economic variables and these income variables, but when you're going forward, you're using forecasts of those variables. So any error in those is going to feed directly into error in your income statistics. So while the model performs fairly well, it's still a fact of life that there is potential error out there, and it's something we need to recognize going forward. In terms of this forecast, there's been 3 months since the last forecast. We have published some of our tracking reports in terms of personal and corporate income tax receipts. What you can see here is that withholding is slightly above zero, but has just been bouncing around that zero line for about 2 years. The significant drop there in total is purely a result of declining estimated payments for the fourth quarter. And that was actually uncharacteristic from prior years. Usually estimated payments tend to be fairly stable within a tax year because of the safe harbor method of just recalling back to last year and paying the same. The only thing we can think of at this early date is that the decline in the stock market in the last month could have necessitated revisions to estimated payments. People could have taken losses and then factored that into their calculation in terms of what they were paying on tax year 2002. One slightly bright note, you have corporate income tax growing on a year-over-year basis now for the past 3 months. What you see there is that prolonged negative period, a slight uptick, and then a drop back down. What it looks like is that long negative period is the actuals, advance payments, et cetera, during the recession. You had slight improvement, but then October is actually the reconciliation period where you have refunds where corporations settle up on a tax year. So that's really the settling up on the 2001 tax year, which was the heart of the recession. So there's every indication now that corporate earnings and corporate profits and tax income are turning the corner. As you will see, however, we have not changed our forecast because there's still incredible volatility around corporate income tax. 3 months don't make a trend in corporate income tax. So in terms of the forecast, which you've already heard, at least the bottom line, we're now projecting $9.34 billion in resources, including the beginning balance for 0103, and that is $244.5 million below what we had projected in December. Now, that is entirely driven by personal income tax. As you can see, corporate income tax is about flat. Our concerns are, even though they're showing some signs of return, this potential energy price risk on the upside could actually eat into corporate profits in the next few months, so we did not buy into any kind of renewed growth in corporate profits. Now, the bottom line question, you see that $245.3 million number, which is the current technical deficit relative to appropriations, and the big question is, what faith at all should we have in that number being accurate? And the question is that, or the answer is that particular number, not a whole lot, in that any particular number has a very little probability of happening. What the real question is what's the probability around that? What can we buy into for with reasonable certainty? And so what I'm going to do here is actually talk about why the revisions were made and what the risks are for the remainder of the biennium, which is 4 months. We actually don't have final numbers on January yet, so there's 5 months of withholding remaining. Previous forecasts, all of the previous forecasts, actually had some amount of employment and personal income recovery built into this biennium. And in fact, the December forecast had employment growing 3% at an annual rate for both the first and the second quarter, personal income growth of 5% in each of these quarters. And that was feeding in somewhat to what the final forecast was for this biennium. In this particular forecast, there's actually no assumption whatsoever anymore of recovery signs this biennium, and that's a big difference. For the last 8 quarters, most of the revisions have had to do with a failure to realize some projected improvement in the economy. There is no projected improvement in this forecast to not realize. So the difference here is that anything that would impact, at least withholding here, would more likely be some kind of negative shock, some kind of negative consequence. A firm packing up, closing, and laying off a bunch of people. That's the kind of risk you're looking at here, rather than somehow we just bought into a recovery that was earlier than it should have been. So, I mean, there's one difference there. You have two estimated payments remaining. Now, with this last fourth quarter estimated payment being so much lower, our forecast for this fiscal year for total estimated payments went from being 5% above 2002 to 5% below. We now actually have negative estimated payment change between the 2 years, primarily as a reflection of that last payment and the fact that people tend to base their payments on the prior year. So that's been built into this forecast. There's no longer even an assumption there that they will tick up next year in reflection of improvement expected. That no longer exists, at least for this first two quarters. Finally, the big if here is refunds versus final payments on tax year 2002. And basically, the worst case scenario there occurred in 2001 or on 2001's tax year when you had 70% refunds versus 30% final payments in all those final returns. And that was way out of line with a normal 45% final and 55% refunds. We actually have a net outflow during tax season in a normal period. But last year was an extreme example. What it turns out in kind of digging into this and analyzing it is that there's a very close relationship between the change in liability from year to year and what that ratio ends up being. When growth is really fast, you end up having a higher proportion of final payments. In fact, because people tend to make their estimated payments based on the prior year. When you have fast liability growth, they underpay and then end up having less refunds and owing more. This last year, what we saw is liability dropped 8.9%, and in fact, then you had this very large shift towards refunds. In the past, what we'd basically done is said, well, this year isn't going to be a negative liability drop like last year, so we're probably going to see more normal final payments and refunds. Recently, in analyzing this and realizing there's such a close tie, it's actually the case that probably the ratio is going to be in between the two extremes because we have flat liability. This forecast now is reflective of sort of a 36-64 ratio between refunds and final payments. And that is the probably causing $100 to $120 million of the current revision was in realizing that there was probably a higher risk. So this is getting at, I think, Senator Devlin's question is that, in fact, much of the revision here is addressing that issue. That still does not mean it couldn't be as bad as 70-30. It's just that there is no real empirical justification for expecting that. The volatility around this, though, is fairly high. One thing I will go back here a second to withholding. The withholding table changed tomorrow. They changed for March. They were never revised to reflect the delay of Measure 88. So that during 2002, it is likely that withholding was lower than it should have been. It's one of your upside risks coming into this tax filing season. We will know better come April when we finally see how this plays out. If it's the case that they underpaid, then you would actually see this shift more slightly towards final payments. You would see net dollars coming in. On the other hand, if for some reason other than withholding, other non-wage sources of income, like capital gains, were far worse than what you would predict from people's estimated payments, then it could go the other way. So there is a significant amount of what we have as your potential error range. We don't think there's a whole lot of potential that withholding will be less than what we're projecting. Really don't see estimated payments declining more than the decline we already have in there, particularly when they tend to be fairly reflective of the prior year. And most of the risk there is around this final payments and refunds issue. But this is a fairly severe split in and of itself. The only time it's been worse, obviously, being last year, which was catastrophic. About $350 million went out the door that was unanticipated last year as a result of that unanticipated high refunds. And so we are saying when we go down the line and say, well, how much worse would withholding be given that we've already taken so many dollars out of it? How much could estimated payments be considering that we basically decimated them? And then this issue, we sum total that up to about $100 million either way. And when you say 90% likelihood, that means you're basically saying 5% it could be above that $100 million. So the shortfall isn't that bad by $100 million, and 5% likelihood that it could potentially be worse than that $100 million. But the scenarios that feed into those are unanticipated. There would have to be something significant occur in Oregon to really take you outside of this ratio. But it's not impossible. It's just improbable. That is the analysis that we've done. It's obviously subject to personal interpretation and or impression.
Thank you for your presentation. Representative Butler, a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question relative to forecasting in general. I understand it's not a scientific, down to a scientific certainty, but how does this relate to other states at this particular time that are doing forecasts? How is Oregon going to stack up? And then historically, how have we been stacking up relative to our forecasts? Are we closer to the what the other states are predicting and coming out?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, one of the things we have to remember is that the differences in the tax structures result in differences in the amount that revenues vary by state. Our state tends to be one of the worst just because of the extreme tied income tax, which is more volatile than a sales tax. And so other states, if you look, you would expect actually that their error ranges historically have been a little less just because they're dealing with a less volatile phenomenon. For instance, we just looked at Washington's forecast, and their error range is about 5% in either direction that they're advising their budget people to be aware of. And that's a little less than, as you'll see, I'm going to move into the future biennia here. I just wanted to get this biennia because it's the most immediate concern. And move into the future biennia, and as you'll see, we've got some information here related to that variance and forecast performance.
Mr. Chair, the reason I ask is I am concerned as we get ready to potentially borrow our way into some degree of prosperity that we may have other states that are going to be trying to do the same thing.
Thank you, Representative. Other questions? Thank you both.
It was a wrap-up of this biennium. The concerns that it seemed to be far more immediate, although next biennium is obviously right there behind that. One that I wanted to do before I went into the forecast for future biennium is discuss this issue of historical forecast performance and what can we expect going forward. And what I've done here is looked at the degree to which actual revenues have departed from the close of session forecast as far back as they've actually been made. This office came into being in 1980. So as you go back, you can see that there's been some significant variance. Only two negative departures, both related to recessions. This one, obviously, by far the most extreme. You see the standard deviation there, and that's just a measure of how these errors have been distributed around the mean. The mean here is actually, the average error here is about 1.6%, meaning that over this period of 11 biennia, the forecast has been 1.6%, a little on the conservative side on average. Whether that's going to hold true forever, we don't know. It's just, it's a historical statistic. And then the standard deviation is the amount that it's varied around that. And across this period, it's been 7.3 percentage points. So what you would say is, for any one of these close of session forecasts, prior to knowing what actually happened, you would say that 70% of the time, the actuals are going to come within 7.3 percentage points of the close of session forecast in either direction. Now, that seems fairly high, and it is. The thing to notice here is that what's driving the extremity of that number is the 1995-97 number there, which is 10.6%, which was purely the result of the unanticipated stock market boom. The close of session forecast was made in 95. 96, you see one of the most unprecedented runs in the stock market. You see all of a sudden this incredible ramp up in high-tech manufacturing and wage rates, bonuses, stock options, etc. And that really, on the high side, was the result of a one-time phenomenon in our history. In particular, it related to Y2K. That was just coming in to being really important driver for business investment right here. It continued for two more biennia, but by that time, the forecaster at the time had clued in to what was going on in the next two were not off by that much. In other words, they were taking recent history and building it into their forecast. And then obviously this current buying is the result of the flip side of that. You had that huge run-up, and now you've had a huge correction. Both the run-up and the correction are unique events, at least with respect to Y2K, which will never happen again in our lifetimes. So there are reasons to believe that these are aberrations. What you would normally do is saying, if you don't believe those are going to happen again, at least within the next 10 years, you would take those out and say, okay, now what has been your forecast performance? And it drops to 4.1 percentage points, excluding those two aberrations. This basically just talks to what I've just said. So in that case, I mean, you would say a standard deviation, if we want to address this, basically encompasses about 70% of what's likely to happen. It's not all. If you want to do all, you would say, well, there's going to be no revenues next year, and then you'd always be right on the high side. $8 billion would probably be a good, can't possibly go below that without nuclear holocaust. There's your lower bound. You'll never go below that, but is that anything that does you any good? Probably not. So, I mean, you're still taking historical statistics and using those to project into the future, but it's better than having nothing at all. What we would say is that somewhere between that 4%, which is normal error for normal times, and 7%, which is very abnormal times, somewhere in the middle there is a safe, recommended assumption for the degree that revenues will actually vary from the forecast.
Got a question, Senator Harper.
$8 is that?
Mr.
Next
Chair,
slide.
Senator Harper, the very next slide. And the only other thing to notice here is that these are based purely on close of session versus actual. So you would not use these statistics in the middle of a buy-in to talk about how is this going to fare out. You would assume that the error rate in normal times would get smaller as you proceeded through the biennium, this biennium notwithstanding. Okay, for 0305, and I think this number has been out there, but we are now forecasting $10.4 billion in total resources. Obviously, beginning balance there is assumed to be zero. And that is a $469 million drop from the prior forecast. This really is a reflection, to go back to that story, of this change in estimating liability and having to justify where the growth would come from. It becomes a very different exercise when you have to say component by component. And in addition, as this recession is dragged along, these concerns about risks, about will Oregon's high-tech sector come back, will the state be a drag on the economy for years to come, these are very real risks, and they're being given additional credence as they become more probable.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
In the accounting profession, we use a standard deviation of 5. You're still within you're well within your standard deviation at 4.3. Is that what I'm reading there? Mm-hmm. On the total for the next biennium?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, not really. I mean, those variances are about the actuals relative to this close of session. We don't even have a close of session forecast yet for this finding.
Okay.
This right here is purely the change between December and now. So when you say go from close of session to 2 years later and you have an actual, that change you're expecting would be no greater than, say, 7.3 on the mm-hmm. outside. This is a 4.3 correction in 3 months.
Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we skipped past what to me is the most important piece of information in your presentation this morning, and that's the previous slide. Recognizing the volatility and the difficulty in forecasting, an actual, if you could maybe address your suggested recommendation here with respect to a reserve of 4 to 7%, that's far in excess of anything that we're anticipating, I believe.
We had 4%.
Something less than 4?
We had about 4%.
About 4%. Well, we would be on the low side of your recommendation. Could you address that, if you would, please?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, mm-hmm. one of the things in our favor here is economic patterns, in that we are now hopefully at the end, but at least approaching the end of a recession. Normal times, and this is the last 50 years, you would see some kind of growth going forward. Now, the extreme variability here was the result of both two recessions and that one boom. So the 7% is probably well on the high side in terms of it would more encompass nearly all likelihood rather than your normal range that you would want to, say, reserve for. But I'm talking about the future. I'm making a projection.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, I liken it to, you know, how that the 7% is kind of it's a long-term possible problem that may be hit, but the likelihood of that happening each and every biennium is a lot smaller. And the 4% is more likely what might happen each biennium. So in terms of putting that like in reserves, I kind of look at the situation as if we were able to construct reserves, I would say we could construct what we might call a long range or a long term rainy day fund and a short term rainy day fund, where there would be one rainy day fund that when you were in the boom times, if somehow you could take and split the kicker with the public and say half of it's going to be kept on a long term rainy day fund for the 7% time that may happen, and lock that up and make sure that there's only certain ways that it would be triggered to be used. And then, for leaving an ending balance, a reserve, go more towards the 4% over a short period of time. So that you cover both of those aspects, you know, for the once in, you know, we don't, recessions are more uncommon than our expansion period. So this is one way I think maybe that you could kind of bridge both aspects.
Senator Morris, a follow-up?
A follow-up, yes. Looking back, what has been the history in terms of recommended reserves?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, it's been more in between those two areas. It's been more of a 6%, and that kind of then is a way to bridge both aspects. If you were just leaving a reserve and didn't have a rainy day fund,
I guess, Mr. Chair, follow up. If there's something to be learned in this particular period, it seems to me that we have not adequately addressed the need for reserves in previous budget cycles. Mm-hmm. And I don't think previous budget cycles have come anywhere near addressing the recommendation that you're making here today. And to me, that's the message of your presentation, is the need for planning for the unknown and the risk in forecasting to avoid these kind of calamities that we've got right now.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, I think that is just a prudent course of action.
Senator Carter?
Mr. Chairman, I find it interesting, this conversation, and because I think it addresses the question and the concern that Representative Morgan has. And I was looking at that 4-7% number, and that is when Tom and those guys talked to us the last time, they said between 90 and 300 million. We chose to use the 90 number. Here we have on here a glaring variance of between 4-7%. And we take the 4%. I think all these guys can do is introduce us to the numbers. It is up to the legislature to decide the number. And so it would appear to me, and no offense to the chairs, to the co-chairs whatsoever, it just seemed to me to be prudent at about 5.1%. But if they were to do that, then they got to deal with all the members that are here. So it just actually shows you it's not a science in terms of the delivery of the numbers. Neither is it a science in terms of the making of the decisions of the dollars that we're going to use. But somewhere along the line that we as a body have to grapple with that decision. And somewhere along the line, also between 1993 and 2003, if we had taken the middle road and also looked at having a larger amount of dollars in a rainy day fund, we would have done a better job too. But again, that is no science. And so obviously it's quality decision making that's going to totally make the difference.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Johnson, did you seek recognition?
Thank you. No, Mr. Chair.
Senator Devlin? Or excuse me, I had Senator Harper who was...
Tom, do you have your reserve fund concepts written down someplace, or would you...
Mr. Chair, yes, I could do that. I don't have them written down.
We need copies of your thoughts on how we establish some kind of reserve, that we institutionalize this, is what I hope we get done this session. But I need to know exactly what you're thinking, if I can read it later. Would that be okay?
Senator Devlin?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think anybody needs to be reminded of this, but I just wanted to put it on the record. Even though we did not really have any established reserve funds other than the stability fund that we've created during this process in this biennium, if we presume that the $450 million that we're going to approve later today and later next week is going to actually come from tobacco settlement funds, although it could come from other sources in the future, we will have used up over $800 million in tobacco settlements as our reserve, plus we've used extensive use of MUPL during this. So in a sense, we've used up what probably is close to a little bit over a 10% reserve, which we never put in place, but which we've used as a reserve. And it's unprecedented finding, so.
Further questions, comments? Thank you. Proceed.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, I think one of the mitigating factors there in terms of what happened during the 90s was Measure 5.
Mm-hmm.
I think I put a serious constraint that otherwise, who knows what decisions would have been made, and it is very likely that more of an attention would have been made to reserving those funds. So in terms of the extended forecast, $10.4 billion next year, as you can see, these are the whole numbers. I think it's more interesting to see the changes. But as you can see, we do have growth built in here, but it's significantly revised downward. This, again, is the impact of reviewing and revising our way of forecasting income and liability. What tends to get talked about more are the percentage changes, because that's what people are comfortable with. If you'll remember, for the December forecast, we had... If you adjusted for the kicker and took it out and were just looking at collections changes, we had a 13.6% growth between this biennium and next, and that is now down to 11.5%, just as a consequence of what we've been talking about here in terms of risk to the economy, in terms of realistic expectations about growth, and how, as Tom showed, there's been revisions to the personal income forecast, and those have fed directly in to our income model. So all of these factors have come into play to revise down, we would say, the profile of our future biennium in terms of collections. And there are long-term risks here to this forecast. Pretty much we've built in some of this. I mean, there's still variance around our scenario, but since our scenario is one of taking into account those risks, you're talking about more serious consequences of whole firms picking up and moving elsewhere. But this is one of the potential risks we have, is we don't know how the high-tech sector is going to come back. On the other hand, we don't know that some other sector does not come into Oregon just like high-tech did during the 80s and 90s. So there's upside risk there as well as downside risk. Capital gains continue to be an issue because they are so volatile. Our current forecast, as you noticed, was brought down significantly from prior forecasts. Yet still, again, there's no guarantee there that you won't see substantial negative corrections that impinge upon our capital gains income and the liability from that. But probably as important as anything is to recognize that with a forecast here that has growth substantially below what we've seen historically in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, that one of the risks here is for a kicker in 05. If the economy were to come back, which now it's shown that it's hesitant to do so, but if for some reason this summer, this fall, you were to see a significant kickback, we would be looking at a kicker in 05. And it doesn't take a whole lot for, I mean, as we've seen, the fluctuation here is 70% of the time it's 15% band, and we're talking about, well, it can't go below zero, or else we have special sessions. It can't go above 2%, or else we have a kicker. So we've got a 2% window in a scenario where everything fluctuates about 15% or within a 15 percentage point window. So that is, I mean, that is one of the risks that people need to be aware of.
Be a nice problem.
Yes.
It would be welcome change, I'm sure.
Well, the other comment you made about the industrial restructuring and maybe some industry comes here. Did you have something in mind?
Mr. Chair, the example that's always been thrown around is biotech. Just as this, it's supposed to have an incredible upswing and everybody's vying, wants a piece of it, but nobody knows where it's going to play out. And these things tend to be unpredictable in terms of where, you know, the locus of particular sectors actually end up. So the possibility is there. What's the likelihood? Nobody at this point knows, I don't think.
Thank you.
The other thing this office does is forecast lottery revenues. I will go through this pretty quickly because they haven't been changing much, nor are they very large enough to deal with your more pressing concerns. But for this biennium, we're looking now at total resources of $735 million, and the change there is about $2 million. Video poker continues to amaze in its growth rate. It amazes the lottery commission, for one. And we've been revising it up, and our error rate on that has been getting lower and lower. I think our model here for at least lottery is performing fairly well, in that the deviations from that are fairly small. So the total ending balance here, which I know has been factored into discussions already, is $10.1 million. Here's our current forecast, and I guess the most noticeable characteristic of this forecast is the drop between this biennium and next biennium. What happens is you have administrative savings that are the result of lottery's expenditures not being the percentage that is assumed in future forecasts. If they have lower expenditures than is calculated in the money they transfer us based upon the sales they make of lottery games, then the residual of that is owed to the state, and it comes to us at the end of each fiscal year in terms of administrative savings. We don't tend to forecast that forward, but in fact, in this biennium, there were both transfers of administrative savings and contingency fund. They basically transferred unnecessary contingency dollars. So that boosted this biennium up, rather than there being anything happening in the next biennium causing a drop. And you'll see you have just characteristic growth that has been occurring basically since 85 when the lottery is created. The only issue with lottery dollars is that the dedication of those dollars has changed over time. More and more dedications just result in fewer and fewer discretionary resources for your budgeting concerns. And in fact, Education Endowment Fund will go up to 18% distributed for the Education Stability Fund, I should say, it changes to. Starting in fiscal year 04. But that, in total, is our presentation.
Do you get into any speculation as to if the number of terminals, speaking of the lottery, were doubled, let's say, in current establishments, what impact that would have on the lottery fund?
Mr. Chair, I haven't done, you know, a quantitative analysis of that. I don't know where they stand relative to capacity. I do know they are still making inroads into, say, particular chains that then have terminals, but I'm not sure what the total sum of capacity is out there. So how much of the demand, is there unmet demand for, you know, a lottery terminal at any one point in time, say 9 o'clock on a Friday night? Whether expanding those terminals would result in additional revenues, or basically is the need met and you just have terminals going unused. I think the lottery would be able to address that if we asked them.
And would that be dependent upon additional games being offered as well?
Mr. Chair, they've actually looked into that in terms of obviously the current discussion about line games versus just the straight poker. And obviously, the number that's being floated around is roughly $100 million in any given fully implemented biennium from offering different games than what are offered now.
$100 million additional.
If they went to line games, if you had poker games on those machines versus just the card games that are on them now.
question?
Roughly.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Either gentleman can answer this question. The idea has been floated to get Portland baseball, we bring in a casino. If we had a casino in Portland, then what would that do to state lottery revenues?
Sick.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm taking that's a rhetorical question.
Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, on page one of your revenue forecast, you've got figures in there for manufacturing at 0.8%, 1% non-manufacturing, and so ups and downs down in the wood products industry. Can you relate those numbers to actual numbers of jobs created? And how does that match up against the reported 130,000 Oregonians that are out of work? And if I look at that, from what I'm seeing, it doesn't match up to page three of a 16% increase, because where are you going to get that in? I mean, all these numbers you showed me really relate to jobs. So if you don't create the jobs to get the revenues, to me it's not matching up.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger. In fact, the composition of tax receipts for the state is a lot less tied to jobs than you would imagine, given the distribution of income and where that income tax comes from. Because, and we've just been looking at this, but the top 25% of filers account for 75% of the income tax. Those are not the jobs that tend to fluctuate during swings in the economy. The bottom 50% of filers, that's bottom 50% in terms of an income bracket, account for only 10% of personal income tax revenues. Those are the jobs that fluctuate, and in fact, there's very little dollars, tax dollars, tied to them. So you find less of a swing. This particular catastrophic drop in personal income tax really is a result of 90% of those dollars were not paid in this biennium by people making over $200,000.
Thank you.
In reduced capital gains, et cetera, et cetera.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Returning back to your forecast for the general fund, you have a current forecast of 10.4 versus a 10.9. The governor's balanced budget was based on the 10.9. If my math is correct, then we're faced with, and the governor's balanced budget had approximately 0.2% ending balance projected. So if we take your 4% plus your reduction in estimated revenues based on today's information, we're looking at the next biennium cutting approximately $900 million then. I just want to make sure that those are numbers that I'm not making false assumptions.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, I'm not sure what the upper number in comparison to is from just the 468, I can imagine being a difference in terms of the expected revenues. I'm not really familiar with any additional dollars that were anticipated or what where the 900 is coming from.
Well,
or what it's relative to.
If the governor's balanced budget was based on a revenue projection of 10.9 and now you've revised that down to 10.4, that's a reduction of 500 million from the governor's budget. The governor's balanced budget had a projected ending balance of 0.2%. That clearly does not meet the 4% minimum that we're talking about. So if you add the 4% to the reduction of $500 million, we are looking at $900 million additional reductions from what we're talking about today. Is that a correct statement, Mr.
Right.
Chair?
Yes.
You're heading out from Butler.
Yep. Right. You're heading out or a tip of the cap?
A tip of the cap. Take your place on the nose.
Thank right. you for pointing that out, Senator. There are other observations, questions.
That's right. We've already pointed out. We just didn't want to see the handwriting on
there. Other questions?
What's going on here?
We thank you both. Appreciate your presentation. Yeah. Look forward to your next visit.
Mr. Chair, I'm
I know you do too, eh, Michael?
Hoping.
Are we going to hear or just worse?
I don't know what the cause.
No, we're working. Oh, I don't know. Anybody else?
I just don't know if it's enough to remember what the what toggles
the office. Thank you, sir.
Huh? Were you listening to that?
No, they just.
Okay.
No, it's. Well, graph or something.
On this one,
you better get early. Somebody has sold us on. I'm very happy that they sold. Somebody else bought it, and it's just a kick. Both of them looking at.
All right, I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 855. Is there anyone signed up to testify on Senate Bill 855? If not, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 855. We'll open a work session, Senate Bill 855. Mr. Rocco, do you want to have some preliminary comments on Senate Bill 855?
Mr. Chair, I believe somebody from Legislative Revenue would like to
that'd be fine.
Describe this bill.
And who gets that opportunity? Elizabeth?
Elizabeth's here.
Thank you. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, since you're just trying to wait on numbers to come, I'd just like to welcome one of my constituents, Mr. Chad Devin, to the legislative process today.
Thank you. Welcome, Chad. Good to see you here. Mr. Warner, would you like to describe Senate Bill 855 before our work session?
Sir, Mr. Chair, should have before you a dash 3, and you'll have to excuse my voice. I'm losing it here with the.
We're losing it, too. Ask Senator Carter.
Mr. Chair, you have the dash 3 amendments before you, and that does several things. One is it changes the reference point. Remember that the Senate Bill 855 has a finding, meaning that one of the conditions that trigger use of the stability fund has been met. And that specific trigger is that you're more than 2% below the close of legislative session forecast. So you have 3 triggers, and those triggers are on an or basis. So that one is the one that's cited in the finding in 855. The dash 3s just changed the reference from the December 2002 forecast to the one you just received a few minutes ago. So it updates that. Obviously, you're well beyond the conditions there, being about 18% below the close of session forecast. The other thing that it does is it changes the date on the transfer amount, or when there's to be funds transferred from the Education Stability Fund to the State School Fund, and it makes it an and/or basis. In the original bill, it's on May 1st, which is consistent with the Constitution for the $150 million that was in Measure 19. But this additional amount can be transferred either April 1st or May 1st. So the idea is to give the Treasurer some flexibility as to when that's to be transferred and to give you optimal flexibility in terms of the general fund and when that's paid out. So the reason for that is to maximize the cash flow issues. And the Treasurer, given that flexibility, be able to see what cash flow is coming in at that time. The final element to the dash threes is that the original 855 has a blank transfer amount, and the dash threes insert $112 million as the amount to be transferred, and that that is very close to the total amount that we feel in consultation with the treasurer is available on a liquid basis. It leaves roughly $16 million in the Education Stability Fund, but the treasurer has informed us that those funds are really not liquid at this time. They're committed in the Oregon Growth Account. So if you look on my revenue impact statement for 855, you'll see that the Education Stability Fund balance is projected to be $16 million after this transfer at the end of this biennium. And then it's projected to grow to $135 million on July 1st, 2005, and to $256 million on July 1st, 2007. Those are consistent with the March forecast you just received. About $118 million is projected growth in the Education Stability Fund next biennium. That's the 18% of lottery dedication. The other thing I would point out, it's also on the revenue impact statement, is that the transfer of the $112 million from the Education Stability Fund reduces interest earnings off the fund this biennium by roughly 3 months. So that estimated amount of reduced interest earnings, which now goes to scholarships and also to retirement of previous lottery debt for schools, that estimated interest earnings loss is $464,000 in 2001-03 and about $9.9 million in 2003-05. That's taking $112 million out. So that's the incremental reduction from taking the additional $112 million out of the principal.
Thank you. Are there questions? Senator Harper has moved the adoption of the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 855. Is there discussion? Objections? Hearing and seeing none, the amendments are agreed to. Senator Harper, do you wish to move Senate Bill 855 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation? He does. Is there discussion? If not, the clerk would please call the roll on Senate Bill 855.
Representative Butler.
Aye.
Representative Patrick.
Aye.
Representative Hansen.
Aye.
Representative Morgan.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Bates.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Tootie Smith.
Aye.
Representative Greg Smith.
Aye.
Chair Miller.
Votes aye.
Senator Duke.
Aye.
Senator Carter.
Aye.
Senator Messerly.
Aye.
Senator George.
Aye.
Senator Dublin.
Aye.
Senator Morris.
Aye.
Senator Harper.
Aye.
Senator Schrader.
Aye.
Motion passes.
Senate Bill 855 is passed to the Senate floor. Close the work session on Senate Bill 855. Now we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 856. And signed up to testify, Mr. Swarthout. Welcome. Please identify yourself for our record and
good
provide
morning, sir.
Your testimony.
Justin Swarthout, and I don't know if I'm written up on the right thing, but I'm not. I guess I want to be called a neutral. I'm just here to talk about kind of what I talked about last week with the medication. I heard this morning from the senator that I am now a student for that on Monday there's going to be something passed for that bill with medication, which will help out people such as myself that have got cut from the bill, or not the bill, but from the Oregon Health Plan. And I heard you guys are working on trying to get that passed. I was shown what was going on. Gordley went over it with me. But I guess I want to come this morning and share that the medications that I shared with you last week, I finally got my last in the mail. And they're here to cover me for the next 3 months. The Oregon Health Plan covered that, my last bill. And I'm pretty much set for, you know, the next 3 months till, you know, if you guys can get that passed on Monday, then they'll, you know, take a couple months, but I'll be able to take meds up till then, which will help me with school and also help me with being, you know, the new student guy up there in Gorley's office. So I look forward to helping out, and I just wanted to, you know, pretty much tell you guys thank you for listening to me last Tuesday. I hope it touched you. I was thanked. I was hugged. I was everything else from all you guys, and that makes me feel very proud. It helps me go on. It helps me get up at 6 this morning and come down here at 7 to help out. And, you know, I hope Oregon citizens, Salem citizens, see now what you guys are really about, that you are not all a bunch of people that are against us, but you're there fighting for us, and you are helping pass these bills. And I say that as being a citizen. I appreciate everything that you do. And I also wanted to say I hope, wanted to let you know, if all of us could pray for Senator Gorley. Someone in her family passed away, her father. And I'm the only one up in the office. I got all these bills I got to put in there. I look forward to it. But if you could all just say a prayer for her, that would be greatly appreciated. I thank you all, and I look forward to seeing you all. Thanks.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 856? If not, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 856. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 856. Mr. Yates?
Chairs and members of the committee, Dick Yates with Legislative Revenue. During the fifth special session, passed or authorized essentially the treasurer and DAS to enter into agreements to sell bonds through a securitization process for $150 million. This bill repeals that action and passes in lieu authority to issue a new type of bond, which is called an appropriation bond, Oregon appropriation bond, in the amount of $450 million. Reading that as you should have the dash two amendments there with you. There's a blank in the bill. The dash two amendments insert $450 million. And transfer that amount of money essentially in May to the general fund. The bill provides essentially for the payment of these bonds, the debt service on these bonds, or states that it is the intent of this current legislative assembly that these bonds be paid from the master settlement payments. They are appropriation bonds. They require an appropriation by each legislature to pay the debt service on these bonds. The bill establishes the bond funds from which these revenues are to be paid, and the fund in which the money goes into sets a expenditure limitation essentially during the current biennium, and these monies flow in during this biennium of a little over $9 million. And I think that's the salient aspect of the bill. I can go into more detail.
Thank you. Are there questions? Representative Morgan.
The Mr. Yates, given that we have a commitment on this funding stream to OHSU, can you tell us I think the question I have is, how far out are we embedding this revenue stream?
10 years.
We've changed numbers here back and forth, and I'm not exactly sure. Perhaps I think I would be better off if we had the Treasury come forth and talk about. We were talking about 10 years. I'm not sure whether that has been extended out for the $450 million or not.
Kate Richardson, Oregon State Treasury. Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, the short answer is these are about on a 10-year repayment, and it's reserving a residual stream of the MSA of approximately $30 million, which is reserving at least about $20 million for the OHSU bond payments and some other smaller pieces such as enforcement of the MSA agreement or the NPM or the participating manufacturers enforcement against them to be able to maintain the stream, and that allows some cushion in case the MSA payments increase or decrease.
So, Mr. Chair, if I might, just to make sure that I have this in my own head straight, effectively for the next 10 years, we have used up the revenue stream.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, the vast majority of it, yes.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Carter.
And on the very serious side, I'm just saying that I'm not going to be continuously willing to borrow from our children's future unless we can think of more solid revenue sources to take care of the situation we're in today. In this state, I will be voting yes on this measure, but this is a notice from Margaret Carter in terms of the future of how we pay for doing business in this state.
Yeah, here, here.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Dukes.
We, in terms of the stream from the Master Settlement Agreement, when we first started getting it, it was coming in a little under projection. Is there a fudge factor in here, or how certain are we that these revenues are going to come in as projected?
Okay. For the record, I'm Chuck Smith with the Oregon State Treasury. The numbers that we're using here are from a national econometric organization that forecasts lottery revenues. Their forecasts are used in every single, tobacco revenues. Their forecasts have been used in every single tobacco sale in the United States. It's the old DRI, which is now Global Insight, or whatever it is. These are as of 2003. These are their newest numbers. And the way this was structured is, as Kate mentioned, $30 million was set aside, and then all remaining forecasted tobacco revenues were used to repay this $450 million in bonds, and they would be repaid over a 10-year period using all remaining revenues, less $30 million each year.
So we're pretty sure we're going to see as much of this money as we're anticipating. Because if it doesn't come in here with what we're doing, we go somewhere else to get it.
Senator Dukes, that's true. This is a credit that is for the general fund. You're earmarking tobacco revenues, and to the extent they're not there, monies have to come from somewhere else. But we do have some cushion built in.
Okay, that's what I wanted to hear. Thank you.
Further questions?
Mr. Yates? To expand on that just a little bit, I think there are several adjustments in the payment stream which are dependent upon the volume of sales by the major manufacturers of tobacco, also dependent on the activities of what are called the non-participating manufacturers. And we have a qualifying statute which requires the state to enforce certain conditions on those non-participating manufacturers, which namely is that they pay into an escrow account. And the stability, if you like, of that payment stream from those national manufacturers is dependent upon our enforcement of the qualified statute. So I guess sort of a contingency, in a sense, to that, to answering that question, is that we do enforce the qualifying statute.
Mr. Chair, can I ask
Senator Duke
a question, since Dick mentioned that A couple of years ago, we put extra enforcement people in the Department of Revenue. Have we laid them off yet?
They were. I do not know if they've been restored or not.
They're coming back.
Well, I know the collections people are, but are the cigarette stamp...
Oh, the rangers?
The task force, which was organized, has been suspended. Now, whether it's been reinstated or not.
Has been suspended?
Yes.
Okay. Just makes me a little nervous.
Mr. Chair, I believe there's a piece of Senate Bill 5548 that restores those activities.
Could you double check? Because I'm nervous. There's a difference between hiring the people who are going to try to collect all of the income tax that's due to us and the people who go out and check to see that we have valid tobacco stamps. So I'm just anxious to know that we're handling both ends.
May I comment further, Mr. Chair? There's two pieces to that. One is the Attorney General's office. It is their responsibility to enforce the qualifying statute. The Department of Revenue's responsibility is to enforce compliance with the Cigarette Tax Law. So those are two separate pieces. Not unrelated.
Okay, further questions?
Representative Bates.
Just for the record, Des, I'd like to make a couple quick statements. One, tobacco settlement is a result of the damage done by cigarettes to the public and the cost of taking care of that. This obviously is being subterfuged by us taking this money. It also is a reflection of our inability either to make cuts or raise new revenue. Some of that is because we have a time crunch we just can't do that in. But I want to make it clear that this is something I'm going to vote for, but begrudgingly like we all are. And it's something we have to do. We're not going to pretend it's the best policy. It's what we have to do this time in this place because we've got to balance this thing out. I'll finish off 0103.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Hansen.
Well, I think this will be my one statement for this whole package. A lot of this absolutely sucks. The cuts, the funding vehicle, the borrowing. Fortunately, there's a little bit of mitigation on some of the things that we were able to put back in. I'm not voting for any of it because I like it. I'm voting because that's the question of maintaining solvency for the state of Oregon, which is our first responsibility, and then when we get past that barrier, we can work on solving some of the state's problems and hope to come up with some wiser vehicles and ways to do that in the future. But for now, it's simply a solvency issue that it's something that we have to do.
Thank you, Representative. Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for chair. Looking at the staff summary, I find the following comments, and I apologize that this has probably been explained before and then I wasn't here. And it's about midway through what the bill does. It says prohibits the pledging of full faith credit, and it talks to the next sentence about the fact that the legislative assembly is not legally compelled to make payment. My question is this because of what would be the implications if we did back this from the standpoint of a constitutional issue?
It would exceed our debt limitations if it was a debt instrument, correct? This is just a moral obligation.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, that's correct.
As opposed to an MO. Other questions? All right. Senator Harper has moved the adoption of the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 856. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the amendments are agreed to. Senator Harper moved Senate Bill 856 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there discussion? If not, Mr. Rocco will call the roll.
Representative Butler.
Aye.
Representative Patrick.
Aye.
Representative Hansen.
Aye.
Representative Morgan.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Bates.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Judy Smith.
Aye.
Representative Greg Smith.
Aye.
Representative Miller.
Aye.
Senator Dukes.
Aye.
Senator Carter.
Aye.
Senator Messerly.
Aye.
Senator George.
Aye.
Senator Devlin.
Aye.
Senator Morse.
Aye.
Senator Harper.
Aye.
Senator Schrader.
Aye.
Motion carried.
Senate Bill 856 is passed to the floor. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 856. now open up public hearing on Senate Bill 859. Do we have a sign-up list? I don't know.
We're checking on it.
Okay. No?
Thank you.
No.
All right, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 859. We'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 859. Mr. Olson, are you describing this for us?
I am, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. I will first take you through the Dash 4 amendments. I'll wait just a moment here while those are being passed out. The Dash 5 amendments, I'll go through first. They replace the original bill, so we'll start with those. Section 1 of the Dash 5 amendments transfers $3.3 million from the Cultural Trust account to the general fund. This is the proceeds from the Boardman property that will be transferred to the general fund. Section 2 transfers $7.4 million from the Department of Transportation operating fund to the general fund. These monies are in excess of what was anticipated coming in this fund during the current biennium, and so that excess is being transferred to the general fund. Section 3, Section 4, and Section 5 are all contingent upon a trigger that is set out in Section 9 that I'll get to in a moment. Section 3 is transferring $15.5 million from the Housing Trust Fund. This fund was established originally in the 1991 legislature, in which they appropriated $14 million to the Housing Trust Fund. And then in 1993, the legislature appropriated an additional $1.5 million. The Housing and Community Services Department uses the interest off of this fund for housing projects that the department supports. Section 4, again, based on the trigger in Section 9, transfers $14.8 million from the Supplemental Employment Department Administrative Fund to the General Fund. The CDAF fund is money that is generated off the interest on the Unemployment Insurance Benefit Reserve Fund. Section 5, again, based on the trigger in Section 9, transfers $1.9 million of video poker proceeds that would otherwise be distributed to counties. This will end up in the state school fund at the end of the biennium. Section 6 will transfer $4 million from the tobacco use reduction account to the general fund. Section 7 transfers $625,000 from the DEQ waste tire recycling account to the general fund. This is an account that's not used much anymore, and this is the amount that DEQ has indicated is no longer needed. Section 8 makes permanent the allotment reductions that were implemented by the governor on January 2nd of this year based on the December revenue forecast. It makes those reductions permanent through the rest of the 2001-03 biennium. Section 9 is the trigger that I've been referring to, which would relate back to the Housing Trust Fund, the CDAF Fund, and the video lottery proceeds. Those amounts would be transferred to the general fund only if the May revenue forecast is $150 million below the forecast that you just received this morning. That's it.
Thank you. Are there questions?
I'm here. Mr. Kocher.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Kocher. Rick, a question on the numbers that we have been reviewing for the Transportation Operating Fund. They've been in the 4.5 range, and this bill now transfers $7,371,543. Could you explain the difference?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, the 4.5 is actually the revenue that has accrued to the taxes paid on motor vehicle fuels that is more than what has been anticipated. The other $2.8 million are there are certain fees that are collected relating to the non-highway uses, and these fees are $2.8 million more than anticipated. So it's two different actual pots of money.
May I clarify that, Mr. Chair?
Please.
In the sheets we've been working off, we've differentiated between the so-called lawnmower fund and the ID fund. They're both combined, I believe, in this.
Thank you. Thank you.
Other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Fletcher.
All right. Senator Schrader has moved the adoption of the Dash 5 amendment to Senate Bill 859. Is there a discussion? Is there objection? And seeing no objection, the amendments are agreed to. The Dash 4 amendments, Mr. Olson?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The Dash 4 amendments relate to the Trust for Cultural Development account. Current law states that the Secretary of State can distribute monies in the Cultural Trust account based on the balance as of July 1st of each year. This amendment would allow the Secretary of State to distribute a portion of that money immediately, $693,000 of it, immediately instead of waiting to July 1st of this year. And then this is a one-time distribution. The distribution date would then revert back to the July 1st date beginning in 2004. This money is actually 42% of the $1.65 million that the Cultural Trust received through donations as of December 31st of 2002.
This is all by virtue of the $500 per person tax credit, tax credit afforded those who contribute to this fund, general fund.
No general fund, that's correct.
Move the debt.
Other than the offset received by the credit. Senator Schrader has moved the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 859. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the amendment is agreed to. Senator Schrader now moves Senate Bill 859 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, I am uncomfortable that, and I've expressed that degree of concern relative to the taking of the lottery funds under Section 5 of the Dash 5 amendments. the counties and the cities, and this is the county portion, I understand, of the video lottery proceeds. The video lottery, all lottery issues belong to the counties originally, and it was the state who took those over. And I am concerned that as we go in and now need to balance our budget, that we're doing so in part on the backs of local governments. And I have expressed to certain members of the legislature and our leadership that we really need to go ahead and address how to bring the counties and the cities, special districts back, and have them pick up their ability and their rights once again to come back in and own a portion of the lotteries and let them tax it according to their own goodwill and pleasure. And the same with regard to tobacco and alcohol, that if we are perpetually going to be reaching back and violating our original agreement, which was made with the counties, that they would own this percentage of the lottery, that really the counties need to be made whole by returning to them their right to tax and attach and participate in lotteries locally. I don't think that's a great situation to be in, but I think that it sure beats the heck out of the state balancing its budget on the backs of the local governments. And I will say this, that I intend to go ahead and vote in favor of this particular piece of legislation today in this forum, but that would not preclude me, and I understand that, from not voting in favor of it as it passes the floor of our chamber.
Thank you, Representative. Further comments? Representative Patridge.
Hey, Mr. Chair. I am concerned about Section 3 of the bill, which is the Housing Development Guarantee Account. We fought hard to try and keep money in there and put money in there to develop housing across the state. The only reason I'm voting for this particular piece of legislation today, with that included, is the fact that we do have, the state has a whole portfolio of housing which is back, which was done with bonds. If we were not able to restore some of the reimbursement rates that were going to assisted living facilities and other things, that portfolio would not be able to sustain itself. So that is the only reason I can vote with good conscience on Section 3. I wanted to put that on the record so that I'm not violative of the people and the things that I've worked on low-income housing.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Co-Chair Miller. I share the same sentiments as Representative Butler in that I think this is a sad commentary that we're balancing our budget on the backs of our counties. And while I'll be casting an aye vote this morning, I do want to have an opportunity to go speak to my folks back home and to find out how this impacts them, and reserve my vote on the House floor based upon the impact this would have on them. Thank you, Mr. Coach.
Thank you. Appreciate your comments. Other comments? If not, Mr. Rocco, would you please call the roll?
Representative Butler?
Aye.
Representative Patrick?
Aye.
Representative Hanson?
Aye.
Representative Morgan?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Bates?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Tootie Smith?
Aye.
Representative Greg Smith?
I noting that I do have a potential conflict of interest as I do have economic development contracts as part of my professional business.
Representative Miller.
Votes aye.
Senator Dukes.
Aye.
Senator Carter.
Aye.
Senator Messerly.
Aye.
Senator George.
Aye.
Senator Devlin.
Aye.
Senator Morris.
Aye.
Senator Schrader.
Aye.
Motion carried.
Senate Bill 859 is passed to the floor. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 859. We'll now open up a public hearing, Senate Bill 5548. Anyone on the
league
roster?
I think I did that one.
Anyone signed up on Senate Bill 5548? Nope. All right, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5548. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 5548. Mr. Rocco?
Mr. Chair, you're being handed out three items, I believe. One is the budget rebalance plan dated at the bottom February 27th. This is it's a single sheet that outlines the components of the plan that has been discussed by leadership and the various caucuses over the last several days. Now, this is the last iteration of that plan, and it is what puts all the bills that you've been talking about today, puts this plan into effect. You also have a list of the reductions that have been identified for agencies, a spreadsheet that lists those reductions that are included in the amendments to Senate Bill 5548, and you should have the dash 4 amendments to 5548, which replaces the original bill. What I'd like to do is briefly go through each section of this bill, not line by line, but to tell you what is in each of the sections. Section 1 includes the reductions to agency budgets of general fund and lottery fund identified on the reduction list that you have. There's approximately $15.3 million worth of reductions in this section. It also disappropriates the remaining balance of the general purpose emergency board allocation from the 2001 session. and special purpose appropriations that were also remaining unspent after the emergency board actions of the last interim. On page 12, starts section 2. This is another one of the reductions. It had to be in a separate section, however, because it's reducing general fund that was provided to the Water Resources Department for the Governor's Watershed Enhancement Board in the 1997 session. They were authorized to spend that over a six-year period. That period has expired, and these monies are would revert at the end of the biennium, but rather than do that, we are taking them at this point. Section 3, which is also on page 12, reduces the general fund made to the Legislative Revenue Office in one of the special sessions to establish a task force. These funds, that the Revenue Office conducted that task force, and these funds were left over after they completed their work. And it also disappropriates an amount that was provided to the Secretary of State for special election costs. This was the September special election that was not needed. And it was a special purpose appropriation to the Emergency Board, and we are disappropriating that in this section. Section 4 starts on page 13. This section supplements appropriations to various programs. This is the section that puts into effect the top part of your rebalance plan, where additions are made to agencies for certain services. In this section, it includes an appropriation to the Department of Revenue for income tax collections. These were to restore positions lost in the House Bill 5100 cuts that were implemented as a result of ballot measure 28's failure. And there's also included here the support for the tobacco tax compliance efforts of the state police. There's restoration of approximately $86,000 to the state police for five positions to help them to restore the positions lost that would help with the tobacco tax compliance efforts.
Mr. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, that's five positions besides the 40 positions that are. So
yes.
There'll be a total of 45.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, there would be this package provides 40 troopers, 40 forensics positions, and then the five additional tobacco tax compliance staffing. Yes.
85.
Section 5, which begins on page 15, is implements various agency rebalance, internal rebalance needs from House Bill 5100 reductions. These are netting out to zero. They're included because, for example, in the Department of Corrections, because of the way appropriation bills are set up, those reductions were taken across the board by line by line. And in this case, in order to avoid release of prisoners, the Department of Corrections has internally rebalanced. And these reductions and changes in their appropriation lines make these agencies balance better within the reductions that they were required to take because of the passage of ballot measure 20,
once
the failure of ballot measure 28.
Conversations, I thought.
Section 7 on page 18. Section 6 on page 18 appropriates $150 million of general fund to the state school fund from the proceeds of the tobacco bonds or appropriation bonds that you just approved in Senate Bill 856. Yes, 856. And the other two sections reduce limitation that was provided in the special sessions. because at that time you had given the department $150 million in other funds of limitation to spend what was then thought to be securitization bonds, which would have been other funds. So this takes away the now empty limitation and gives them $150 million of general fund.
The state isn't cooperating with it, brings back all this money.
Well, Section 7, also on page 18, shifts the $112 million general fund to the state school fund, and that this is a result of the bill you just approved, Senate Bill 855. Section 8 on page 19 shifts the lottery funds that are included in the reduction plan of the ending balance lottery monies into the state school fund and takes general fund out as part of the rebalance plan. Section 9 on page 19 shifts $1.9 million of video lottery proceeds from the county share into the state school fund and takes general fund out. Section 10 is the trigger mechanism that says that shift of the video lottery will only occur if the forecast goes down by more than $150 million exclusive of the tobacco revenue bonds that are going to be provided to the general fund in May. And Section 11 is an emergency clause.
Thank you, Mr. Rocco. Are there questions?
Nicely framed.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dukes.
Just curious, Ken, from House Bill 5100, those cuts, how much of the human services, or what in the human services, have we not restored here?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, we could go through the individual items that weren't restored. The total cuts to the Department of Human Services because of that measure failing were approximately $88 million, I believe. And on the issues and problems list that you see, there's been about $4.3 million restored for levels 10 and 11 in seniors and in OMAP. There's about $1 million roughly restored for medically needy programs, $7.9 restored for the health plan standard prescription drugs, $10.4 million restored for long-term care reimbursement provider rates. There's been $7.4 million restored for Staley settlement agreement, and an additional $530,000 restored to community mental health. Now, some of those were not all due to House Bill 5100, but some of the cuts were also due to the allotment reduction, January allotment reduction. So not all of the cuts have been restored, but this would be out of that $88 million plus DHS's share of the allotment reduction.
That's helpful. Could you give me the Staley amount one more time?
The Staley amount restored in Senate Bill 5548 is $7.4 million.
Thank you.
And in the original House Bill 5100, they were reduced by, I believe, close to $12 million. However, due to some savings in the slower use of services, this amount is believed to keep the program going until decisions can be made in 03-05.
Thank you.
Other questions? Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just as a point of clarification, Ken, the 0103 budget rebalance plan that you, your office, put out dated February 26th, this statute memorializes the summary that you had prepared at that time.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, this is the latest, this describes the latest plan that was determined yesterday afternoon.
Another question? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. The concern I've got is how many positions are we adding back as we approve this budget? I can count a couple of hundred, it looks like, here in a hurry.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I am not sure exactly how many positions are being added back. I know in the reduction list there are approximately 7.76 FTE that would be eliminated this biennium. The add backs to programs, I know there are positions being added back for the Department of Revenue, and those are collections positions. The intent there is that these positions will generate an additional $13 million for the general fund through their collection activities, and then there are the positions added back for troopers and forensics.
Mr. Chair, let me just clarify it. Again, the cuts cut about seven or eight people, seven plus positions, but the add backs here include 85 troopers and 113 DOR, and I don't know how many others might be there, but that's nearly 200 add backs in this process. So I'm concerned about the fact that we're cutting seven positions and adding 200.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, this, I'm not sure how many positions that is. It's 7.76 FTE, and since there are only 3 months left in the biennium, that would be the number of positions would be larger. However, it probably isn't the 200 that are being added back. You're correct.
Other questions? All right, Senator Schrader is moving the -4 amendments to Senate Bill 5548. Is there a discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dukes.
I'm going to vote for this bill today, but I don't know what I'm going to do on the floor.
Okay, you want to adopt an amendment?
I think
first
I need some more information.
I appreciate that. Is this regarding the amendment?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Representative Patridge.
Mr. Chair, just for the record, page 6, Judicial Department, new judicial positions. I had a conversation with Mr. Rocco. These were items which were already granted to judicial in the January e-board. Apparently those are not. So I just wanted to put that on the record that these were not positions that were granted. These are monies that were reserved to the e-board.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Rocco, on page 17, the district attorney's salaries, the add back of $110,000. I was unaware that was going to be occurring. What does that include?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, that is combined. If you see there's two pluses and one negative. And that is one of these internal rebalancings where the district attorneys needed to switch between categories in order to implement the cuts that were made in House Bill 5100. So it's a net of zero.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Bates?
Just for the record, Mr. Co-Chair, This is a result of a lot of hard work, and I appreciate that, but I also know it's a result of certain people trying to hold back their votes for their pet projects. Those of us who have not done that are seeing some things go down this that we would like to see put back, and we're not asking those to be put back in. I'm going to vote for this here and probably on the floor also. Things such as cigarette evasion and historical societies and other issues which are important to us maybe individually, I've had to look past and vote for this as a package to make sure the state stays solvent. I'm somewhat concerned that we at times are rewarding bad behavior in this building for special projects, and I am concerned about that. We'll continue to be concerned about it. Having said all that, I will vote for it now, and I'm fairly certain I'll vote for it.
Thank you, Representative. All right, the amendments are before us. If there's no further discussion, are there objections to the amendments? Hearing and seeing none, the amendments are agreed to. Senator Schrader moves Senate Bill 5548 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Recognize Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think Representative Hansen basically said the statement that I wanted to say about what's in this entire package.
I think if each one of us voted no on the package, if we had some strong objections to a portion of it, you wouldn't probably have many aye votes here at the committee. I have talked to Senator Schrader, and I haven't had a chance yet to talk to the other co-chair, Representative Miller. But I would assume, since we have taken some of these actions, particularly relative to, like, cessation and prevention, and particularly relative to, like, some of the advocacy commissions and a number of other issues, that since those items are still in the governor's recommended budget for 03-05, that although we've had to make these decisions here, and I have no delusions about what 03-05 is going to be like, because I think if we've had to swallow hard here to pass this budget, we're going to be swallowing hard on many days as we go through the 03-05 budget, and it's going to be very difficult, and we're going to have to take a lot of votes that we would probably prefer not to take. But I wanted to simply be assured by both co-chairs that those budgets will still be reviewed in the 03-05 process, and ultimately they will still be subject to the desire of the body as a whole on those budgets. So there's still a chance for those parties to make their case in the 03-05 budget. And that's basically not entirely a rhetorical question. It is asking for some response. So,
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
My response would be that is accurate. Certainly in this upcoming session, we're going to have to revisit a whole lot of things, given our current forecast and where we are. I am moving forward with this reduction package, though, with an eye that these would be things we would strongly consider carrying forward into our reductions for 03-05. I realize individual members may have different views, and that's certainly fine. But at some point, we're going to have to make some very, very, very tough decisions. We have given people here an opportunity, I think, to look to other funds. That's why I've done the suspension as opposed to elimination of a lot of these well-thought-out commissions and advocacy groups. And I also point out, you know, there's been a lot of heartache on what's been out there and what's going on. And I think if there's some small bit of pride this legislature can take, it can be, frankly, from the comments of the one citizen that testified today, that we have had public hearings, we have listened to people's concerns. Given the magnitude of the problem we face, we are trying to throw a lifeline to a lot of different individuals out there, be it mental health for children, keeping seniors in long-term care, trying to make sure that our streets are safe. Those types of things, I think you can take a little bit of pride in, that you've tried to add some things that throw a lifeline at least for the next few months. And then at that point in time, hopefully all of you will have done your work in your subcommittees and been able to make the tough decisions. And if there's an opportunity, maybe come up with a better solution than what we have right now. I appreciate everyone's work and indulgence and time to move forward, I'm afraid.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm going to, this is a broken record, but I need to just touch on one other issue. The tobacco taxes were sold to us on the precept that, number one, there would be some local money in it, and maybe not number one, but certainly it somewhere between one and two, the prevention aspect. And we are taking away all of the prevention resource during this next 4 months. I'm anxious about that, but I wanted to express my concern over the trickery that this becomes to the voters of the state of Oregon when they move forward and say, yes, after many attempts to pass these kinds of things, yes, we will go ahead and vote in favor of this particular issue if it is being used, if some portion is being used for prevention, and then in this process we pull out the prevention. That does not in and of itself take away my overall desire to support the co-chairs and our leadership in passing out a balanced budget. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Senator Carter.
For some time now, I've enjoyed being on the Ways and Means Committee. When I first came here, I was taught that it's kind of the creme de la creme of hard decision-making. And people were on this committee because they did not mind making hard decision-making and standing them the test of their own leadership in their own communities. And this is certainly one of those times when it's here. I would hope I'm going to continue to enjoy being with a group of people that are the creme de la creme of hard decision makers in this state. And there are also people who support their co-chairs for the decisions that we have to make. They're also the people that are closer to the numbers than any other members in each of our bodies. And as such, and we know the hard decisions that we have to make, I would hope that the members on both the House and the Senate side are people who have been exposed to numbers more so than any other members of each of the bodies in each of the houses. And game playing would not have its residence among us, and that we can make these hard decisions knowing that some of the programs that we dearly care about might have to go down the drain for those that are sicker than sick and those that are crippled and maimed and everything else. I want very much for you to take a good look at commissions. The people are saying, no, we want commissions to go by the wayside. But I should have to say to you, Mr. Co-Chair, each of you, that if this is not the body, then we need to look back at what we need to do a long time ago. When you don't play the game as a good team player, then there are some answers that have to be answered.
Thank you, Senator. I probably should have spoken earlier about the no vote that I'm intending to cast on this bill.
I am, Mr. Chairman.
I beg your pardon?
I will have some comments about that.
Okay, that's fine. My reason for doing so, although I appreciate the work of the co-chair and the vice chair and others who were in negotiations over the past week and a half, whatever it's been, 2 weeks, in my view, particularly yesterday afternoon, things went beyond what ought to be contained in this bill on the add-back side. I think we can do better. I'm also not convinced about the level of support required to pass this bill in the House. And so I wouldn't want to signal necessarily that this train is on the track, and that it's just going to sail through without some objection, without some reservation, without some observation. So I did not want to cast my vote in this roll call sense after all of the members of the House had their opportunity, but I wanted to let you know in advance that I'll be a no vote. With that, Mr. Rocco, would you please call the roll?
Representative Butler?
Aye.
Representative Patridge?
Aye.
Representative Hanson?
Aye.
Representative Morgan?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Bates?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Tootie Smith?
Aye.
Representative Greg Smith?
No.
Representative Miller?
No.
Senator Dukes?
Aye.
Senator Carter?
Aye.
Senator Messerly?
Aye.
Senator George?
Aye.
Senator Devlin?
Aye.
Senator Morse?
Aye.
Senator Harper?
Aye.
Senator Schrader?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Senate Bill 5548 is passed to the floor. With that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 5548. Is there anything further to come before the committee this morning?
You said you're going to get a chance to say something about your
vote. Oh, go right ahead, Senator Carter.
Okay. I reserve the right to say it later.
Thank you. I know that you will. Is there anything further to come before the committee? If not, thank you for your attendance. We are adjourned.